So there's a new report from MIT that talks about a lot of generative AI projects failing. They interviewed 150 executives and looked at 350 employees and an analysis of 300 public AI deployments. And it seems like only 5% of them are succeeding for some definition of success, where it actually makes a material impact in P&L.
And the report is titled The Gen AI Divide, State of AI in Business 2025, and is part of MIT's NANDA initiative. And they talk about the main reason of failure. It isn't the AI technology itself, but a learning gap. Organizations often don't understand how to use AI tools effectively or how to design workflows that capture their benefits. Many companies try to build their own AI tools internally, but these efforts succeed only about one third as often as purchasing solutions from specialized vendors like yours and mine, or building partnerships, which succeed about two thirds of the time. Maybe talk about the failure rate a little bit and how it's affected the markets.
Yeah, it seems to have really spooked the markets, and there's as much as 5% drop in some of the leading AI companies' stock.
So it's worth an episode here. You know, the divide between successful and stalled projects is growing, and those that are mastering human AI collaboration pulling ahead of the rest. So it's going to be one hell of an episode.
Yeah, looking forward to it. So this seems to be our agent season, right? All episodes talking about various aspects of agent building and agent usage.
Yeah. I mean, last episode we spoke a lot about horizontal versus vertical.
Yeah.
What's your summary? What's your takeaway?
I think that both models work, and I think where we ended was that in some ways the T model, where you have a lot of breadth, but you go really deep into certain space.
Use cases, yeah.
Use cases is probably the best model for agents, and particularly for agents, because I think the expectation from AI is so much higher and so much human-like. Like we said that when we hire execs, we're always looking for that T-shape, that they mm-hmm. can go really deep into mm-hmm. some things, but they can be mile-wide mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And I think the successful agent products and agent companies are also going to be like that.
So today we're going to talk about a very similar dichotomy, I guess, where it's about build versus buy.
Yeah.
There's a big report that came out of academia, MIT mm-hmm. report on the trials and tribulations of AI. And, you know, it was such a strong report that, and the fact that the stock market is so much teetering at the edge that every time something like this comes out of sudden, like there's a 5% change to NVIDIA stock price. There's something about that report that's worth talking about, build versus buy.
Yeah.
So obviously the big conclusion in the report is about how AI is, flattering to deceive. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe let's start with that. Like, what is your takeaway from the discussions that are happening? What are you seeing from the customers on, are we close, are we far? Is it delivering the ROI that it's supposed to deliver? Are we burning tokens for the sake of burning tokens? Where do you think we are in this journey?
I think it's all part of a grand experiment. We are all learning. I definitely see a lot of enthusiasm inside companies from people who've never built before, trying their hands and getting this amazing superpower that they could build prototypes really fast and they could play with it and they could put their stamp on it, their creativity on it. But at the same time, you know, the discipline of building products that last, that gets used by a lot of people or even few people over a long period is not just about like the initial spark and the execution to get to code. There's a lot of sweat and hard work and deep thinking that goes into it. And not discouraging anyone from experimenting and trying out, but my personal takeaway is that even when you're building regular software, you need a few iterations. But when you're building AI, you need to plan for a lot of iterations. You know, Google Search, arguably one of the most successful AI products in the world, has been iterating for the last 20, 25 years. And I bet you every week there's 5 improvements going in there. And that's how it gets to be that good. Because most of our intuitions about how users actually behave and what they need and what sparks within ends up being wrong. Like maybe 1 in 20 is right. And so there's no other way than to build something, put it in front of people, learn from it. And so if you're thinking that like you have this great idea and you'll build something and then all of a sudden people will start using it, you're in for a surprise.
So maybe we can tier this market. Let's say that there is a pyramid.
Yeah.
There's a top of the rung of this. You can put Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, maybe a few very technical companies up there. I mean, many of them were trying to figure out, even in the last decade or the decade before that, how to really compete with the public cloud.
Yeah.
And eventually they came and said, look, we're going to have to use the public cloud. But they were using OpenStack and open networking and all sorts of open source things to try to do this on their own. But they had enough engineers, enough of a brand to attract those people.
Yeah.
And then there's the next rung that will either hire Palantir to do things or they have enough people in-house who are kind of an offshoot of IT, but they'll have a data and AI team who will want to do this on their own. And then there's the next rung below that will say, look, we understand, we'll have architects, but we won't have coders and developers, so we'll get system integrators. Including maybe Accenture and Infosys and all these other guys, Wipro and others, to come and build it for them.
Yeah.
And then there's the mid-market, which is like, hey, we need to actually, but this is not our business. We don't have enough economies of scale to actually bring data and AI teams like that. And of course, then there's the SMB, which just needs plug and play. So it looks like there is a whole pyramid here. And a lot of what we're talking about in AI today is basically a lot of bespoke work that people are doing up here. But it's probably a discussion to be had on the middle of the pyramid and the base of the pyramid as well, for which there is very little real AI going on as well.
Yeah.
I mean, the SaaS companies are putting a little bit of AI pixie dust to really make it look like there is AI there. And I think there's real struggles for, I mean, I would say even agent force in companies of that nature to be in the middle of this. And then, of course, at the bottom of this pyramid, I think it's even harder. I mean, in productivity software, you can say that maybe they'll get enough out of Google Workspace and O365 and maybe Canva and, you know, others are going to do this. Notion will just bring a little bit of that as well. But what do you think about this whole pyramid, and how should we really think about build versus buy up here to, you know, buy and configure down here to plug and play self-service down here? Like, anything that you want to comment on, and maybe we really need to have a straighted, segmented discussion about this, because it's not a simple answer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the internal enterprise apps have existed for, I don't know, the last 30, 40, 50 years, and they definitely serve a purpose. Once something becomes common enough, then it becomes a product, and it's much better way of building it, because then you're accounting for a lot more people's need and amortizing the cost and also amortizing the learning. So, you know, I can name so many like $10 billion companies that came out of products that were initially internal tools at Google. I think,
why don't you start with the easy ones?
Yeah.
Let's start with SMB.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned iterations, but maybe we start with the other end of what's hard about AI in the SMB.
Yeah. Yeah.
It has to be self-serve. It has to be plug and play.
Yeah.
Design plays a huge role in this.
Yeah.
Right. So let's start there on design alone. Like, if people were to deliver AI for $10-$20 a seat a month, I think there is definitely a lot to be done right here. And by the way, you might not even sell by the seat. It could be being sold by the token. In fact, there's a big discussion that's underway right now about, in the VC world, about two kinds of companies. There's ones that are called the supernovas that are negative gross margin right now. And the hope is that they get to 20-25% gross margin. And then from there, hopefully, they actually... So there's the immense power of distribution that needs to come in. So cursors and, you know, Claude codes and many others are in this boat. I mean, maybe even Lovable and others. So they're getting to 100 million in year two itself. But they also are negative gross margin right now. So it has to be plug and play, like Lovable, like Cursor, but it has to be immensely viral. And I think they probably are paying way more for tokens than they even charging from the end user.
Yeah.
And the VC money is being used to really even bring, make them whole.
Yeah.
Then, you know, you get to what the VC world is calling shooting stars compared to supernovas, the shooting stars that are basically getting to 100 million in year four, but they will have SaaS-like gross margins, you know, up to 60% to begin with, like the way it was with ServiceNow, like in 2012 or something. You know, there's still you know, services to be had, bespoke engineering, customization, implementation to be done, and that probably starts to go mid-market and above. So at the base of the pyramid, there is a role for supernovas who are playing a negative gross margin. What do you think is going on in that world? Why will it sustain? And will the VCs and their LPs get their money back? And it's an important one. And by the way, this is about value creation just as much.
Yeah.
There must be enough value, enough word of mouth, enough virality going on here. But eventually, how do they go from negative gross margin to the positive territory to 50, 60, 70% gross margin? Because eventually it's about net margin, not even gross margin. Like when you see in the P&L, for some idea to be sustainable business, it's not just about positive gross margin. It has to be enough gross margin that when you pay for the cost of distribution. And you could argue that distribution is going to be cheap for them. The sales and marketing cost, the R&D cost is not that high. Say more on this and before we get to the higher levels, because we are have much more difficult discussions up there, you know.
No, I think I'm definitely seeing, like, in my team sometimes uses Lovable, sometimes uses Replit. My 12-year-old daughter is using these two tools to build things. So they definitely penetrated our common consciousness and have found utility for it. The key question is, are they generating more value than the cost of running the operations? Now, they could be, for the time being, discounting the price so that they could capture mind share and capture market share.
But does the architecture work?
Yeah.
Because if you look at Canva, Notion, Figma, Slack, they were not that heavy on the server side. There was an edge-based thing. They would use all the CPU, the browser, the cores, the memory, all that stuff on the laptop. So there was a edge-based sort of bias in anything that was design-heavy. What's happening right now?
I mean, these things are definitely not edge-based. The very heavy server cost component to it. And sooner or later, the cost needs to be passed on to the customers.
So how will it work? Let's say Cursor. And I'm sorry for putting you on the spot. We probably are doing this improv, but Cursor versus Claude Code. There's a company that owns the model. And they have taken a design approach to CLI. They're like, okay, look, we're not in the visual IDE. We're not in VS Code. We are outside it, but then we're capturing the context. And we can get to editing and stuff like that. but that's the model company that is owning some UI.
Hmm.
And then there's a hardcore UI company,
hmm.
which has taken over VS Code,
hmm.
but has no model.
Yeah, yeah.
So who do you think wins in this? Because one of them can control the price of the other and keep them in negative margin territory for a while.
I don't think anybody is in control of the market. I remember when this whole DeepSeek moment happened, then all of a sudden Perplexity came out guns blazing. Who's the wrapper company now? There's enough competition happening in the model space that they will continue to experience downward pressure in pricing.
Mm-hmm.
And if not the latest greatest model of the moment, like just one rung before that would get commoditized all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I don't think it's like model companies are in control. But the same goes for the UX companies as well. I think somebody comes up with a paradigm that becomes popular. All of a sudden, everybody starts copying that paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
And it has become so easy to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so fast the market moves that I think other than execution speed, there's almost nothing else left.
Mm. But what has changed between the 90s? Because obviously we go back to the other bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And try to learn from it, or maybe say, look, it's different this time. Now, I don't know what it means to be different.
Hmm.
But obviously, we have printed $17 more trillion of the US dollar in the last 15 years. So money is way cheaper than it was in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah.
The world is more integrated. I mean, there's the Middle Eastern money. There is obviously all sorts of money that's coming in here too. But could we draw parallels with the bandwidth glut of the 90s, the networking, basically over-deployment that happened, there was a crash that came, and of course companies that survived and thrived because they believed in an operating system culture, like even Amazon.com, they're like, look, we're not just a .com company.
Mm-hmm.
We have built a business that really understands customer service, understands what it means to squeeze more and more from a backend. But also we understand billing and metering and, commerce and authentication, all sorts of things. They were good at payments and compared to many other dot-coms that didn't survive. What are the parallels to draw from that bubble that eventually burst and this bubble that we're in? Will this go longer? Because if anything, what I hear from Jay Powell, interest rates are going to come down now, which means money gets even cheaper, in the coming years. So will this bubble last longer? And what kind of companies will go to the other side?
It's a question of bridging, right? So the vision was there in 99, but it took much longer to get to the dreamland, and in the middle there was a bubble burst. If anything, I feel like we've gotten better at managing that, and I don't think there's going to be quote-unquote bubble burst. There will be disillusionment. There will be
Explain, what do you mean there's a disillusionment right now?
Yeah.
There's a class of companies that have a lot of money
because
the VCs are basically funding it.
Yeah.
There's another class of companies that's trying to squeeze on money. Like, you know, if you look at Fortune 10, Fortune 50, Fortune 100, the tariff pressure, the lack of growth in GDP, the aging population, the lack of productivity growth in nations, they're trying to squeeze as much as possible. So when is the disillusionment coming? Because on one side, there is immense... I would say irrational exuberance.
Yeah.
And in the other, they're trying to figure out if AI is the answer to not getting enough immigration, because, you know, we are in this geopolitical world, but there is, it's a political word to even say immigration. So they're like, okay, if it's not immigration, what is it? And it's probably agents, you know, I can do this with more. So will there be a disillusionment, and what kind that the MIT report talked about are we going to see?
So, here's what I think. whenever we have a new technology or new tool on the scene, we need to do lots of experimentation to figure out what's the best usage for it. And we need to go through several iterations of, oh, we thought this is going to work, but this actually doesn't work, or this is not a sustainable economic model. Let's do another twist on it. Let's do another twist on it. And a few generations of these trials eventually leads to, you know, Netflix and Facebooks and LinkedIn's and whatever else mm-hmm. we created in this era, right?
Mm-hmm. But you said something very interesting about Netflix's and Facebook's. The one reason why they went through multiple iterations is because they had somebody at the helm who was willing to be stubborn.
Yeah.
But in the IT world, CIOs are changing every 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
And when the new CIO comes, they change the last CIO strategy in a big way. So there's no longevity and stubbornness at the top. Is that one reason why there's so much disillusionment about building versus, you know, going? And because I think what you brought about right now is just, I was just in 10 seconds, I'm like, okay, what's the imagery of these companies?
Yeah.
It's the stubbornness of Jeff Bezos and Reed Hastings and Reed Hoffman and Mark Zuckerberg that basically had them plow through this chaos to go rein in the chaos on the other side. Is that the reason why the top of the pyramid suffers, and what the MIT report is actually going to bring more of, and what Gartner calls the valley of despair and disillusionment?
Yeah, it definitely brought something that resonates. I think it's not just that. I spent 3.5 years at Microsoft working on search engine.
You were working on Bing?
Working on... It wasn't called Bing then. 6 months after I left, it was called Bing. But, yeah. And then I came over to Google. And the thing that completely...
Do you write the Bing thing on your resume? Because people give you a hard time for that. Because I'm like, wow. I architected Bing. I'm like, okay.
Fortunately or unfortunately, I haven't had to brush my resume for a long time.
Like, you know, to avoid the hard question, let me just go start company. But yeah, keep going, you know, you'll say.
The thing that really amazed me, and by the way, like, I have great friends at Microsoft and they'll fix the problem, but 2007, when I moved from Microsoft to Google, the thing that I saw was that if I had an idea that, like, you know, I can figure out which topic is closer to which topic, and based on that, what search results can I bring in when I don't have enough main topic or something like that, the amount of effort it took for an engineer to collect the data, do some analysis over web scale data, run experiments, look at and conclude that this is a good experiment, was like 6 month project. At Google, they had shrunk it down to 1 week. And amazing amount of engineering went into doing that. And it was not just engineering, it was also a process, it was the thinking.
It's interesting that you say this, by the way. The fact that they used commodity hardware, there was a separation of concern, they had the job framework. I think they were adding generic infrastructure rather than the bespoke NetApp and the bespoke Windows and the bespoke SQL Server.
Yeah.
There was a lot of IT dependence at Microsoft
versus
engineering and commodity, generalized commodity sort of scale that was going on. I mean, maybe say a few words on that as well.
I remember like in those days, we had servers that costed $50,000 for a bunch of services. And all the storage was local, and like you could mount file share from one server to the other, but it wasn't a distributed file system until very late into my stint at Microsoft. And even then, it was very beginning of their journey in that direction.
You're saying the economies of scale of infrastructure is a big determinant in experimentation.
Like, yeah. Yeah, I mean, The main point I want to say is that if you're building something ambitious, you have to be prepared for like 10, 20 iterations of that idea and not give up in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires having that mindset, shrinking the time scale of experimentation, like optimizing for learning every step of the way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So also having the right feedback,
mm-hmm.
Ear on the ground, to know when you deploy something, how your users are reacting to it, what pain they're experiencing.
I think this last 5 minutes has been eye-opening for me as well, because maybe there's an episode to be had here about the economy of scale of infrastructure and how they basically are a big determinant in experimentation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you don't have an SRE culture,
mm-hmm.
and everything is actually like, you know, more like pets, you have to get pets rather than cattle and bees, you know, it's like,
mm-hmm.
Google made infrastructure into bees and mm-hmm. cattle as opposed to pets. You should spend more time on that alone, isn't
mm-hmm.
because we're talking about experimentation and that's a big part of
mm-hmm.
this piece as well. But the base of the pyramid, what else should it be looking for beyond just, hey, any developer can go buy Cursor,
mm-hmm.
and any sort of quasi no code, low code person can go use Lovable.
Mm-hmm.
What else do we learn from this base of the pyramid? Any sort of predictions you have about who will survive and who will not?
I think predictions are always fun. I think like people who have a strong product management mindset and design thinking mindset and experimentation mindset are the ones who are going to survive. And I'm not saying this about like necessarily startups or companies building it versus internal teams. I think we'll see this on both sides. By the nature of it, it's easier for like startups and product companies to have the design and product people in
mm-hmm.
In the seats. But wherever you see that mindset,
mm-hmm.
Is who is going to win.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was looking for one more thing from
mm-hmm.
your answer,
mm-hmm.
which was a business mindset
mm-hmm.
of conserving money.
Yeah.
And I mean, like Jeff Bezos was all about like, okay, every cent matters.
Mm-hmm.
And he survived and thrived.
Mm-hmm.
Yet others like Reed Hastings, I don't think they had a huge love from the VCs on this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, man, I've got to make money to go
mm-hmm.
create more innovation and so on. I think there is an owner's mindset about how
mm-hmm.
every dollar, every cent matters.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the companies that survived.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were not in this honeymoon thing that lasted forever. Like, look, I'll keep raising money.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, that's the way I'll actually. I mean, like every year, you have to pay the dues on gross margin.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to pay the dues on distribution costs. And only then can you go and do what you have to do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like that's the other piece of this that needs to really, really work? Because again, we have not seen this before when there's, I mean, maybe in the dot-com era, there were lots of negative
mm-hmm.
gross margin companies too.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
back then, bandwidth was still expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And there were companies that were actually reselling mm-hmm. bandwidth for like, you know, less than what they were actually buying it for.
Mm-hmm.
I think the business mindset, the acumen of dollars and cents at a P&L level, the income
mm-hmm.
statement level, those are the companies that probably survived and thrived.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
if you don't have that, and if you don't have that owner's mindset,
yeah,
and if you keep thinking that money is free forever,
yeah,
I think eventually VCs also move on.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
How do you connect it to the MIT report and 95%?
See, I feel like the at the base of the pyramid, individual people are looking for viral products
mm.
because they have a FOMO of, am I missing out on Cursor?
Mm.
Am I missing out on Lovable?
Mm.
So there is a market for,
mm.
for that base of the pyramid, you know.
Mm.
My thing is, who will be able to sustain this over the course of the next
mm.
3 to 5 years?
Mm.
And I would bet on Anthropic.
Mm.
more than Cursor right now. I mean, I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that Cursor moves to open source and the rest is history, and they move to the edge and the laptop and the rest is history. And maybe that's what will actually save Cursor. That they're like, look, we just waited and waited and waited until we didn't need any extra money because we moved to the laptop. And now we could use the resources of open source models and things like that. Maybe that's what will save them, you know, because you know, depending on expensive model companies is not, you know, or if the cost of distribution becomes so cheap that they didn't really have to worry about anything but 10, 20, 30% gross margin business.
So there's a huge bet going on here, which is orders of magnitude reduction in cost of inference, right? Which we have seen happen at least a few times, right?
Yeah, I mean, and maybe that's where it might be that, look, for a lot of tasks, you know, if you basically did have so much demand for generating so many Python tokens or, you know, JavaScript tokens, then supply will actually come in and basically make it cheaper and cheaper. And the three model companies, Gemini and OpenAI and Anthropic, will continue to compete on this. You know? It's very possible, very possible.
Yeah.
You know? So there's a market for sure there. Now, from there, we get to the middle of the pyramid, the mid-market, where they don't have Goldman Sachs-like engineering talent to just work on tech side of things. You know, there's a lot of buy and configure. And they have a business to run. And they're trying to figure out how to, depending on the spectrum where you are, either you're growing at 10% and you're consolidating the industry and you're buying competitors and things like that. There's not enough regulatory pressure for you not to buy companies and so on. Or, you know, you're probably growing at 15, 20, 30% and you continue to look for efficiencies and such. But they buy a lot, you know, they buy a lot. The mid-market is the underbelly of America's economy as well. And there is a lot there about ease of use and operating systems. You know, Windows is what they embraced early on. They took longer to get to Linux until it became easy enough to use and so on. So in that mid-market, definitely they'll buy. But what do you think of AI there? Like, who is really, apart from SaaS companies putting a checkbox on their AI solutions, is anybody delivering AI? And maybe you could say, look, productivity is all they care for right now, as opposed to ERP and CRM and places like that. And they're getting enough from productivity tools, especially in the knowledge workspace they're doing. Like, do you feel like they're getting enough from Google Workspace and, you know, O365 and, you know, other such things that they're using in productivity space itself?
I think there's a significant gap between what we are all imagining it could be, where things are. So, like, for example, a lot of people spend time sending emails. Why aren't emails auto-drafted? Now, the fact of the matter is that most people give LLMs a try to author their emails, and most of the time they're disappointed, and they give it a few tries and then they move on and say, like, I'll write the damn thing myself instead of asking some. And I've been experimenting with this, that how to use LLMs in writing my emails and things like that. And what I often realize is that once you have collected all the context in one place, then actually they are not bad. So for example, if I'm sending a follow-up meeting, a follow-up email, I'll pull the entire transcript of my last three conversations, and then I will write sort of the general idea of what I want, and then I'll ask it to write the thing, and it'll write something beautifully polished and with all the context. But today I'm having to do all of that work, and my context lives all over. Sometimes it lives in meeting transcript, sometimes it lives in some app, sometimes it's in my head. How do you engineer all that context in place is the name of the game in my mind. So just like beyond a check mark, there's a huge amount of context engineering that needs to happen before these things really unlock the next level.
Will they get there?
Yeah.
Is a key question. Because, yeah. I mean, if you assume that all I use is Google's tools for collaboration and emails and things like that, you're probably at a good spot, you know, because it hopefully knows everything.
Yeah.
But even then, what are the other tools they're using? Because they could be in so many other places as well. Will the big guys who actually deliver a bulk of productivity tools and workspaces, will they have enough product management to get into HubSpot, to get into Salesforce, to get into Jira, to get into ServiceNow and other such places, or even Zoom, because you know I could be a specialist Zoom shop as opposed to using Google Meet or whatever else. Is that the big challenge? That they might not have the most amount of curiosity for the diversity that exists in the mid-market?
Yeah, I think it's always been integration, the biggest challenge, integration of information. And that hasn't changed with AI significantly. Maybe in a couple of years, integration code becomes auto-written by LLMs and then this whole thing.
But isn't AI's biggest role being the integrator? Like, you know, you said sometimes it's my head. Up until now, in the last 50 years of knowledge work, all the integration is happening up here, which is why I write up the email, because I remember most of the things.
Yeah.
If AI were to really say what its biggest role, don't you think it's integration? Like, if it doesn't integrate, because that's what context is.
Yeah.
A lot of context is recall and integrate.
Yeah, yeah.
So, where will the mid-market derive value? And maybe this is why the Valley company that is stubborn about integration and saying, look, I will be the best integrator. Because I don't own Atlassian's data. I don't own Salesforce's HubSpot's data or whatever, you know, that you have. But if I can be really good at the product management around this, then you'll see true value.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe that is one big takeaway,
that
who does the best job of integration. And the big companies, they don't have the patience, nor do they actually realize that, because nobody dies at a big company if they didn't do integration right. And there's not enough humility to really do take others' data and bring it all together to one place. Yeah. Any comments on that? Any thoughts on that?
No, I think it's always been the case that the company that can bring seamlessly data from multiple places and put it in one place for you to then integrate and do useful things has won. And traditionally, it's not been the biggest providers. It's always been...
And the challenge is also the community, by the way, because, you know, Informatica and MuleSoft and all these sort of integration things were probably for the upmarket, you know, the large enterprise and so on. The simple integrations, like with Workato or Zapier, IFTTT stuff, you know, when you publish an event from some, you know, system like this and you subscribe here and so on. That stuff, I think the mid-market got right.
Yeah,
but they needed to use a Workato or a Zapier or an N8N or some such engine to bring it all together. But I wonder if that market is also up for disruption, simply because you have to, integration is not just pub and sub, but it's indexing.
Yeah.
It's a ton of indexing. You know? So you need to build vector databases. And so the integrators of the mid-market, you take a Salesforce integrator partner who was using Workato or Zapier to bring things from maybe a HubSpot marketing cloud to a Salesforce sales cloud and do it all together. Neither the Salesforce partner nor the Zapier Workato platform were good with data at rest. You know, whether it was SQL or, you know, indexing, vector database, open source, all this stuff. So what will happen to this market? Is there an opportunity?
As you were saying, I was thinking, just like data warehousing became a thing, right? That you pull tables from all the places and then put it in one place and then gave it a nice interface on top of which you could do a lot of things and squash silos.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen a little bit of this in terms of like companies like Glean pulling data from a bunch of places. But what we haven't seen is a suite of applications on top of it and the underlying infrastructure that enables that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And of course, you need to be really good at IFTTT, but beyond that as well.
Yeah.
Because if I now need a ServiceNow workflow engine,
yeah.
and all of a sudden I have a gobbledygook of things that just come together. But I think the epiphany for me while I was talking to you was how the mid-market also needs a simple and easy to use warehouse-like thinking for everything that is not SQL.
Yeah.
Because yeah, of course, if you have relational tables and if you thought about SQL, SQL will be one engine for AI, and we'll get into some of that later on too. But now there's a RAG engine and there's an MCP engine that will get into legacy APIs and all that, which will also where you publish workflows that people could use. It's a lot of work for Workato, Zapier, Anytan, and all these companies to figure out. But beyond that, also for a Salesforce partner who was into configuring and customizing Salesforce, because they were good at customizing data, object model, custom attributes, custom objects, a lot of that storage piece, which at the core was what SaaS was in the last 20 years, was really customizing storage and putting an HTML wrapper on top of it. Speaking of wrapper companies, you know, this is, I'm going to probably digress here, but in 2001 to 2004, you know, the biggest thing that was being talked at Oracle, that Salesforce is just a wrapper on databases. So what we hear now about wrapper companies on LLMs is a very similar thing that we used to talk about back in the day. Like, oh, what is it? Just an HTML wrapper on top of a database, you know. But there's something to be said about how the mid-market also deserves warehousing of another kind with RAG and vector databases and so on and as well, you know, which will require an operating system thinking, like the way Windows was, eventually what Linux became, you know. Let's get to the top of the pyramid now, you know, like these large enterprises, they think that they have engineers and so on. What will the complexity be there? You know, obviously they know their business. Hopefully they've known this for 30, 40, 50 years. There's going to be, you know, a Google agent space coming there and talking about things. Or they'll have a Palantir, you know, to come and do things. Or they'll have an Accenture come and do things. And they'll all basically go and say, look, you can build. What will the complexities of that build be, which the MIT report probably talks about just as much, versus buy, configure, and then build?
I think it's... I was talking to a friend who in his company shall remain nameless, but there's a lot of excitement coming from the CEO that like agent this, agent that, we need to do these agents. So what's the first thing they do? They hire a consulting company to go interview all the departments about their needs and then come back with a 40-page report. Right? And then there's another engagement with a consulting company to prioritize the 40-page report. And then they're going after, like, okay, this use case, who's going to build it? And it's all disjointed set of people. And I got a look at some of the stuff, and I was like, this is never going to succeed.
And why so? Say more on, because theoretically, pedantically, they were doing the right things by going user in, user research in, use case in, and yet you're saying they might not succeed. What's your sort of reasoning behind it, you know?
I think this sort of wide approach with very little depth is where I see the problems.
I think I go back to this thing about stubbornness and gut.
Yeah.
Versus let the data say which one really is where this will be, and then you get into this data gathering mode.
Hmm.
Is that what you mean? Where you either have a gut on where AI could be very helpful and you just go deep into it?
So if you think from the perspective of the company that was hired to produce this report,
mm-hmm.
what are their motivations? Something that looks smart on the paper.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And something that looks smart on the paper almost always is never the answer in terms of what product that needs to mm-hmm. be built.
Because there's no iteration in that.
Yeah. Right. So unless there's somebody whose job is to see through the end of the process.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, you said that there's iterative process.
Yeah.
You have to keep going with this stubbornness of Reed Hastings and yeah. Mark Zuckerberg, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what was their approach to then going a use case and going deep with it?
So what I heard was that there's some, one of the mega vendors is going to send a few engineers there
mm-hmm.
and they're going to build whatever they ask them to build
mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and then they're going to see how that works.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it basically, obviously we all have biases because we come from an operating mm-hmm. system world.
Yeah.
So we always want repeatability
mm-hmm.
and the notion of a platform
mm-hmm.
is how you bring leverage to your different engagements. We'll probably get into an episode on mm-hmm. that alone, the idea of an operating system from AI. But the stuff that fails versus the stuff that succeeds, like how do we even look back in the last 20, 30 years of tech?
Hmm.
So what succeeded?
Hmm.
Like did Walmart succeed in building or did they have to acquire a Jet.com
hmm.
to really make it successful? You know,
hmm.
I'm trying to figure out, even in the Global 2000,
hmm.
what did they build
hmm.
that eventually succeeded? And I'm talking about, even if a CEO were to be stable for 5 years in a Global mm. 2000, the CIO is not, you know, they're changing mm. every 3 years. So mm. it's always a kind of going back and forth on strategy. And mm. Is this the real issue? The fact that they don't have stubborn leaders who long last enough
mm.
to actually go see through this multiple iterations of it? And obviously we should talk about the product mm. thinking versus yeah. the project thinking as well,
yeah.
because these are not project things. These are yeah. products
yeah.
that you have
yeah.
to see through as well. Is that the conclusion we are reaching, that you need stubbornness, you need longevity in design thinking and just seeing through something through 10 iterations?
And incentives. Incentives is a huge part of it. So last week I was talking to some entrepreneur who is in space of responding to inbound leads. And what he was saying was that when he talks to CMOs, he often gets relegated to marketing ops. And in marketing ops, their KPIs are, is the product available? How many tickets are being filed against that product? Their KPI is not like how much inbound leads it generated.
Well, you can connect them to us.
Yeah.
We'll help them with tickets. You know. It's a good lead gen if a podcast delivers a lead in. So please, connect them to us. But go ahead, please.
But I think the most of the IT orgs are not really incentivized to produce great business outcomes. It's, they're good people. They want good business outcomes. But what they're measured on and what they're incentivized on is keeping the
lights
on, bringing the products that the business is asking for,
mm-hmm.
Not making a mistake.
And iterations are frowned upon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it basically looks like it's about the culture of building versus the culture of buying and configuring.
Mm.
And I think it basically goes back to the longevity of an idea that mm. you're able to. And maybe on product alone, like the product thinking versus the project thinking. Those projects come and go.
Yeah.
But products survive. I mean, they will say that, look, in the last 20 years, I've built lots of custom apps.
Hmm.
that were small MongoDB with a small, you know, LAMP stack on top of it or something, you know. And it was a great internal app that was useful for a workflow and so on. Will that be the argument for building small agents for small internal use cases? I mean, maybe that's the compromise that, look, for small little use cases, they'll stitch together whatever they have to. But will software be as simple as that as we try to stitch all this context? I mean, is the bar for AI level software or agent level software going to be the same as workflows of the last 20 years or better? Because if it's just a glorified workflow, you can call that an agent too. In fact, we'll get into what Alex DeMarcus thinks an agent is. You know, he's like, okay, it has to be autonomous. We should even get into infinite loops if it has to do something. But do you think that we'll also take a lot of old workflows and make them into a little bit more generative with a prompt engineering on top of... I mean, maybe that is what building becomes for the enterprise then. Build better workflows with a modern LLM sort of generative output or something.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a spectrum, right? And people will try different things, and it's for some use cases, a very deterministic workflow, then you do this, then call an LLM, then do that, call an LLM, it's just exactly the right thing.
And maybe that's a good first step.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, where it's generating an output like a PDF completely by itself, and I mean, basically leveraging the generalized task framework of a big LLM to really make the workflow of the last 20 years look cool and sexy and better. Yeah. Maybe that alone is building.
I was just thinking of what internal apps I've seen, right? So at ThoughtSpot, at some point, we built an internal app for pricing because pricing was getting complex enough based on usage and volume and users and things like that. It served a good purpose. It was relatively inexpensive too.
Was it like a MongoDB stack or something? What was it?
It used one of those internal IT
platforms,
right? And it,
so like a Salesforce app?
It was actually an independent thing.
I see.
So it didn't have too many dependencies, but it served a good purpose for a while, and then the pricing structure changed, the products changed, and there was nobody to maintain it, so it died on the vine after that.
You're saying it was better than Excel spreadsheets?
Yeah.
But then, because we had to host the spreadsheet through a database, maybe that is the aha moment then. A lot of things that happen in Excel.
Yeah.
If you have to give them a place where multiple people can go, that becomes a database, and you need an HTML wrapper on top of it with some ACLs and authorization, and that's an internal app. And in the world of agents, there's probably going to be a similar thing, which is a smaller thing. You know? I think we definitely, I mean, what I keep coming back to is the stubbornness of building something that you need to really maintain. And but there's one last piece that the Valley companies get incentivized for: adoption and engagement, which also for a lot of internal builders in large companies, they're not incentivized, nor are they trained, because, you know, there is no sort of revenue to be measured. It's funny money in some sense. Anything on distribution, engagement, adoption, that comes in the way of this disillusionment?
Yeah, I think one of the things that people often struggle with is, yes, this seems like a useful thing. At what point in user's day would they have a trigger to go in here? Unless you answer that question, it'll look like a great idea in practice, like in theory, but it'll just sit there and the user will not even think of going in there.
So habits is...
Yeah.
So does it come back to design?
Yeah.
But what would you recommend? Like, let's say that enterprise architects are longer lived people in an enterprise.
Yeah.
And they have to be stubborn about their ideas that they're building on. And they'll probably have enough chops to stitch together a lot of different things and so on. Maybe MCP helps, you know, in some ways to really connect to other systems. Because there's crowdsourcing of data happening through MCP now. What could they think about design and adoption and engagement that could be helpful to our viewers? You know,
I think I keep coming back to the idea of iteration. I think the single biggest fallacy that I see is the thinking that I have seen a need. If I build the product, people will definitely use it. And once you realize that time and again this is not proven to be true, it's kind of like you wire up a complex circuit and you expect the first time you turn it on, everything will just work magically. No, you'll have to go and debug it and see where there was a loose connection or where you need to adjust something. And you cannot give up till you've debugged everything. Like the first time you wire up a program, right? Like there's 200 compilers if you're working in a compiled language comes, and then you have to be stubbornly looking at each one of them and seeing why is this happening, why is this happening, why is this happening. And in case of writing code, it's easier because the feedback is almost instantaneous. In case of deploying a product, that feedback, gathering that feedback itself is pretty complex.
So how the enterprise architects under-promise, get the permission to iterate and to debug with the end users within their enterprise, and then over-deliver over time. Is that the big takeaway for them? Like under-promise, debug,
yeah.
Get the permission to iterate. Failure is an okay thing. And buy time to be like Reed Hastings. To basically go over-deliver over time.
And that's the reason why sometimes people do design partnerships as well, right? Because it's like, I want the value. I'm okay with living through a few iterations of the product because this thing is important. I want to see this in the world. So the same process that mid-market goes through with design partnership with startup, they can do it internally as well. Right? But it has to be that kind of process and that kind of expectation setting.
I think it's interesting, the last thing you mentioned about design partnerships, it looks like it's calling a friend, you know, just like in, you know, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. You actually call a friend sometimes, you know. And the Valley companies provide that kind of friendship because the incentives are aligned and they're stubborn about their thinking, and you just bring a little bit of boost from the outside world to give your current idea some energy and longevity. Is that a wrap? Do you want to say some things about the pyramid and you know, basically how we've gotten to this MIT report and what do you think goes from here?
I think I've been talking to enough Fortune 500s lately and trying to figure out what they need in terms of IT that I see lots of problems. And it's not a surprise to see this kind of 95% number. A lot of times it's a question of iteration and the willingness to live through those iterations. A lot of times it's a question of incentives and what were the original motivation. Like, everybody likes a shiny project and everybody wants to learn what this whole AI thing is that's promising to change our lives as we live it. But yeah, products, building products that get adopted is a hard thing. And it's not all about just the availability of amazingly smart models. There's a lot that goes into building products.
And the only thing I'll add to that is the complexities that come in large companies, the balance of trade discussions, that decisions that are imposed from higher ups, simply because there was a more complex balance of trade discussion about doing business with quote-unquote partners, because money goes this way, it has to come this way as well, kind of stuff. That adds to a lot of the complexity in the larger enterprise, you know, because decisions and ideas and technologies and platforms are not just being used because they are the best,
yeah,
but also because this could be a good balance of trade-off as well, you know. So my commiserations with a lot of enterprise architects out there, even the C-level people who are having to really make suboptimal decisions because in the larger scheme of things, this could be a good business decision or something, you know. Great conversation. At least I had a lot of epiphany moments as well on some of this stuff here. We probably need to do a few things with just calling a friend with MCP as well. And so let's have that discussion. I know we have talked a lot about guests in the last couple of weeks. So let's get some guests as well. Looks like the next several weeks we probably can infuse some sort of external new thinking as well, which goes beyond this echo chamber of Amit and Dheeraj as well. But thank you. Looking forward to the next one.
Thank you.